Hello and greetings, friends. We've got a bonus Chapo episode for you. Today, I'm backed up by Noah Cohen, our friend from Blowback, who you might remember from such Chapo episodes, is when he helped help me interview journalist Tom O'Neill about his book Chaos, which explores the many connections between the CIA and the Manson murders. On today's show, we have a similar case that is sure to induce mental illness if you think too hard about it. We are pleased to be joined by Zachary Treats and Christian Hansen, the creators of a new Netflix documentary series, The Octopus Murders. Zachary Treats and Christian Hansen. Zachary and Christian, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Okay, so I've seen the first two episodes of this series, and it is terrifying and fascinating. And it's like, this is a story that goes back to the 1980s, 1990s. But basically, it starts with the, I could say alleged suicide, but it's my show, so I will say the murder of an investigative journalist named Danny Casolaro. And Christian, I want to start with you. How did you first come to know about Danny Casolaro's case and the subject he was investigating at the time of his death?
I really just stumbled upon it. I was researching the private prison industry, and one of the major players in that is this company called the Wackenhut Corporation. And in the early 80s, Wackenhut, which is a huge private security conglomerate, had formed a joint venture with an obscure, tiny Native American tribe in the Coachella Valley. And they had plans to manufacture biological weapons and night vision goggles and automatic submachine guns for like the Nicaraguan Contras and proxy wars like that. And Danny Casolaro was looking into the Wackenhut Corporation and its connections to the Cabazon reservation. So that's how I just stumbled upon the story of Danny. And he seemed like a really cool and interesting guy. And his book that he died writing sounded wild. And it, from what I could tell, nobody really tried to pick up all the pieces where they fell when he passed away. And it's just been sitting there. And I'm a photojournalist. I'm not I guess I am now an investigator, but I was like, well, somebody's got to tell this guy's story. I mean, he died writing it, and the pieces fell on the floor, and I reluctantly kind of, but also I was excited and intrigued. I picked up the pieces, and here we are now, like 12 years later.
And Zachary, how did you become involved in this project, and what can you tell our listeners about who Danny Casolaro was before his untimely end?
Right. Well, when the agency assigned me to be Christian's friend, I just knew that he was heading to the big time, and my job was just to steer him in the wrong directions. So Christian and I grew up together in Kentucky. So we're friends from Louisville. We met in middle school, friends in high school. And so he's always just been my homie. And he told me about this story. You know, he was working as a photojournalist, usually working for the New York Times. That's how I knew Christian's kind of professional interests, you know. And but he started telling me about Danny and all the other stuff he's just mentioned. And it gets, you know, weirder and weirder. This is, you know, 11, 12 years ago. And I just thought it was, you know, an interesting story. And then Christian got more and more into it. And I was like, me and our friends and his sisters, we were all a little worried about Christian at certain points, just getting, you know, first off from his own obsession with it. And then when he started talking to the people that he had told us about, it was, you know, an element of no matter whether these guys are reliable or not, they don't seem like they're all great, upstanding citizens, like they might be dangerous perhaps. So there's a worry on that front. And then when Michael Reconosciuto was getting out of prison, who's one of Danny's key sources, one of the people that Christian was talking to, he was getting out of prison in 2017 after 26 years in federal prison. And Christian and I were talking about it. And, you know, we were just like, I mean, my opinion was we had no intention of making a documentary. I was just like, if we ever wanted to do anything, you want to write your book or anything, we are going to regret it for the rest of our lives if we don't just take a chance on going out there and picking him up from prison. And Michael, you know, luckily for us, was interested, was okay with that, you know, 26 years in jail. Suddenly he's in a car with these two dudes.
We put it on Zach's credit. We flew to Los Angeles, drove around Los Angeles for like a day or 2 days trying to scrap together the right gear that we needed, audio kit and a camera and lenses. And we're just driving around LA, putting it all on Zach's credit card. And then we took our friend Alejandro's broken down car out to California. Was some issue with the trunk on the way out there?
The trunk closed, but the car broke down on the way to the prison. I mean, this documentary essentially is one piece of a Honda Civic away from not existing.
Well, like a real documentary filmmaker, you have to devote your resources to the camera and audio, not the car per se. Yeah. But Zachary, like when you started like filming this project, was it like, did you think you were going to be making a movie about how your friend turned into Jake Gyllenhaal's character from Zodiac and not just the movie Zodiac that both of you are now starring in?
I mean, Zodiac is a great reference point, by the way, for this. And I just want to throw one quick Zodiac story in there really quick. It never makes it into our movie, which is, it was a great reference for us when Robert Downey Jr.'s character is living on the boat, you know, Christian, while we were pitching this story, was living on a boat in the boat basin in New York City. And
wow, like MacGyver.
I would like, you know, call him. I was writing the treatment or whatever. And I would call him and be like, who's this person or whatever. And then I was watching Zodiac and the line is like, he's looking for Jake files Gyllenhaal or whatever. Jake Gyllenhaal is looking for years later. And Robert Downey Jr. is like, I don't know. I moved on to a boat. Okay. Like, why you can't find the documents. And I was like, this is Christian right now.
He's like, I tossed him. I lost him. And Jake's like, what? You tossed him or you lost him? He's like, I moved on to a boat. And I was living on a sailboat at the time.
All right. Sorry. Well, to answer your question.
Robert Downey Jr. Says in that scene, if it mattered so much, why didn't you do anything about it? And I think, like, you know, Christian, I think you very much upheld his call to do something about it with this, like I said, fascinating and terrifying story.
But yeah, to answer your question really quick is, you know, I knew that we would be in the film in some respect because we were, because we just picked him up, picked Michael up. And there was this real symmetry between Danny meeting Michael in when he's at the beginning of his, he's just arrested in 1991, in March of 1991. And then 26 years later, us picking him up, we just knew that there was no way to tell it without us in there. I don't love when documentary filmmakers, just as a rule, kind of make a story about themselves when it's really about somebody else, you know, when it's like, well, this is my journey into it.
Yeah.
With this, and our producers really actually bear credit or blame for really being like, you guys are a part of the story, whether you want to be or not. So you got to put yourselves in, you know, like we need to see it through your frame. And I was like, I know, you know, I was just like, it was like a intervention or something. I was like, I know we'll do it.
Did it give you more control as a director though, Zach?
I mean, I love essay films in general, that sort of format, you know, the personalization of it, not necessarily like this is about something else, but it's really about me. But when it is a personal story, I love that kind of firsthand thing. So yeah, it's nice to be able to, whenever you have more control over what the thing is, and with a documentary, that's really tough when you're trying to capture things like you have no idea what somebody's going to say. When you can say it, or when I can talk to you and I know you, yeah, it's just another layer that I think was really fun to be able to play with, and whatever, it gives a proxy to the audience of what it feels like to go into this. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Well, yeah, I just watching the first two episodes, I feel like I was definitely getting into it. And before I thought I'd sort of turn things over to Noah, who has researched this case a lot and sort of comes to it with his own interests and perspective, I guess I just want to begin like with the actual story here, which like your story begins with the alleged suicide of journalist Danny Casolaro in a motel in West Virginia in 1991. But I want to talk about where the story began for him, which like most sort of sprawling narratives begins with something that seems very simple and dry and kind of boring, but in this narrative sprawls into like a Leviathan level of murder, corruption, and crime. And the story it starts out with
a contract dispute.
Yeah, a contract dispute over like very early computer software in the early days of like computer programming. A company called Innslaw was contracted by the Justice Department to write software that would allow law enforcement agencies essentially to compare just data across, like, you know, voluminous files of legal cases to see connections and reference these reference past legal cases very easily.
I mean, it was like a really early and sort of first stab at creating digital databases of government information that could be regularly accessed by government officials across the country at all levels. It just so happened that the data in this case was essentially arrest records and other criminal information, meaning like criminal records that could be shared between among prosecutors. But it's like, it's helpful to think of Promise as like a gigantic indexing tool that was just kind of one of the first ever ones that was bidding for government contracting at that scale with like a digital computerized product.
So Christian, could you tell us what happened to the company Innslaw when they created this like quite revolutionary and effective form of software? What happened with them in the Justice Department who contracted them to fulfill
They were given like an initial pilot project of, I think, to install the software into
20
a subset of U.S. attorney's offices and around the country. And if that pilot project went well, they would expand the software to be the standard U.S. DOJ case management software. And pretty early on in the implementation and installation of the contract, everything goes tits up. I mean, the DOJ stops paying. They say that there's problems with this, and this, and they're not fulfilling their end of the bargain. And it's all very confusing. And then the former U.S. Attorney General Elliot Richardson, who's this like lion figure, this famous figure in Washington D.C., he's representing Innslaw. He goes to the Justice Department. He's like, well, I've got his major clout. I'll settle this for you guys. I'll just go in and talk to him, and we'll clear this up. And you'll get your money. They're owed about $6.8 million or eight. You know, under $10 million, but a significant sum of money in the early 80s. And, you know, basically Elliot Richardson can't do anything about it. And the company goes bankrupt.
And just some reference here, Elliot Richardson is a guy who became famous because he was the attorney general that resigned rather than fire the prosecutors investigating Watergate, correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
So yeah, he's a guy with a lot of clout who sort of put his integrity on the line for this company that was apparently getting like just having their work stolen by the Justice Department.
Yeah.
And Danny was a journalist for a computer trade publication. And actually, like, listeners may not know this, but Silicon Valley was actually only one of two major computer software and programming hubs in the country in the 80s and 90s. The other really big one, for especially the purposes of this episode of Chapo, was Northern Virginia. And therein, you know, Danny Casolaro comes across this case. He hears about it and he gets in touch with Bill Hamilton directly. And that kind of sets Casolaro on
Bill
this
Hamilton
journey.
Bill Hamilton, who is the head of Innslaw. The company.
Yeah, sorry, Bill Hamilton, head of Innslaw. And where does Danny go from Innslaw?
So it's also it's interesting, like Danny's sort of it's sort of a perfect storm because there are very few journalists that have a deep background in computer software. But then also Danny had investigated the Watergate case in the early 70s. His next door or his one of his neighbors in McLean, Virginia as a child was James Jesus Angleton. I mean, he's sort of like interested in the spy and conspiracy world, but then he's also got a technical background in computer. So he's kind of the guy. He's obscure, but he's ready to go. Like, he's ready to write the book on the Innslaw case.
And he has a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. I just want to add this in because he thinks of himself as this poet and novelist, like a Hemingway-like character who, of course, was a journalist, you know, to support himself when he was writing books. So he's like looking for the big story, something big. And it's like he just happens to have a background in computers and really know this obscure world better than most people possibly could.
Danny met with the founder of Innslaw in August of 1990. A few months prior to that, this founder, Bill Hamilton, got a call from a guy named Michael Reconosciuto, the same one Zach and I mentioned as having picked up from prison. And he had told Bill Hamilton, that basically a federal bankruptcy judge had ruled that the Justice Department stole the InSlaw software using trickery, fraud, and deceit. And then that ruling was then upheld in an appeals court. And at this point in the story, in August 1990, there's a third court hearing that's like gearing up and in the works.
So yeah, like it's appealed. The judge that ruled in favor of InSlaw is essentially kicked off the bench and replaced with the guy prosecuting or like defending on behalf of the government. So it's just the judge is just a federal judge is basically fired and replaced by the guy who basically helped the Department of Justice steal this promised software.
Yeah. There's a lot of weird stuff going on. That's all very clear. That's all very on the surface. The ruling is very clear. Trickery, fraud, and deceit couldn't be in more clear terms. But the question of why is not clear at all.
Why the Justice Department won't just settle with this company, pay him a few million dollars. It's a tiny contract for the government, and it's like the lifeline of this company. Just pay him, move on, and like we'll just keep on going. So Bill is just beating down the door of anything he can find to answer that question of why. And Danny is kind of stepping in 1990 to try to answer that question.
And then you brought up Mike Riconosciuto, who's also this like pretty wild and enigmatic character. He is a child prodigy. I don't know if you said in the documentary, but I remember he claimed to have gone, he went to Stanford.
Yeah. But he was 16.
Yes. And he was like, worked in a lab with the Nobel laureate. He who remembered him as having, specifically as being like a bright guy.
The kind of guy who shows up to the first day of college at 16 with his homemade, with a homemade argon laser.
Exactly.
Yes.
Thank you.
And he's also then gets into drug dealing and other criminal rackets. And he has a distinctive look, and his nickname in the press at different points is Fat Mike, or as a moniker. At least when somebody told me about who he was, they were like, well, you got to know about Fat Mike. And I thought they meant the NoFX guy. the thing that to me was like super interesting about Riconosciuto is that he's only like the first in a series of people who exist in this kind of world and in the story you tell, who all sound kind of similar in that, like, they have vague dealings with the government. They're also criminals. They also tell a lot of lies. You can't totally trust them. But a lot of the times there is some truth in what they say, and that truth can be very scary. So what is it that Riconosciuto says to Hamilton that then gets to Casolaro that sort of, I think, is like, part of the ignition fuel that sets at least Casolaro go?
From my recollection of that conversation, Bill documented this 2-hour-long call he had with Michael. And, the first thing he says is, have you ever heard of the Wackenhut Corporation? And he's like, talks about the Wackenhut Corporation, who's on its board of directors. It's this who's who of the intelligence world, department head.
Bill Casey and Frank Carlucci are two people on the Wackenhut board. Listeners of the show will remember them.
Bill Casey was outside counsel, right? There's this Indian reservation in the Coachella Valley called the Cabazon Band of Mission Indians. And in the early 80s, the Wackenhut Corporation formed a joint venture with this Native American reservation. And I was the head of research for this joint venture. And among other projects we were working on, which included biological weapons and machine guns and night vision goggles, we took your software source code for your software, and I put a back door into the software, and which then we sold to other countries through third party cutouts. And now the US government has been monitoring the people who bought the software are using the software there's a back door into the databases now.
And this was also, I think, like it's worth like it's twofold here, because this is also Hamilton learns like the company InSlaw hadn't known that other foreign governments were using their product, their software, until they got a letter in the mail from the Canadian government.
That was really funny, because they had no idea that their software was in the hands of foreign governments until Canada contacted them to ask them, hey, can you do how do we change this into French? Because it has to be, bilingual for Canada.
Yeah.
Well, and this also, though, however, this is answers the why. Because the why, as to why something like InSlaw would matter so much, is that InSlaw is not just about, making sure that, you know, small contracts go to favored friends, because maybe it's a bit about that, but it's also, and perhaps really mostly, about the fact that Ince Law was a backdoor that the government, American government, could sell to other governments and then spy on them and could monitor the people in their systems and the people that they were processing. And I think that's a, it's a very,
it's a great idea.
It still happens all the time. The NSA has many, I mean, I've reported on this, but like the NSA has an entire division called the Commercial Solutions Center that is devoted ostensibly, like publicly, they say that their mission is to like work with companies to make their stuff secure. When the reality is that, of course, like there's an offensive component, and what they're really also trying to do is find ways into foreign systems. And this also to the Casolaro, just to ask a question on this point.
Yeah.
You brought up the Cabazon Band of Mission Indian Reservation. Mm-hmm. So a listener may be wondering, like, hold on a minute. Like, why does an Indian reservation in the Coachella Valley have anything? Like, why are they shacked up with this like renegade computer hacker guy and Ince Law software being stolen and Wacken Hut? What's their interest in an Indian reservation?
Yeah, I mean, so this in the early 80s or late 70s, a man named John Philip Nichols had wound up on the reservation. This guy named John Philip Nichols had this belief that the Native American reservations are sovereign nations, not just sort of, contiguous to the United States, not part of the United States, their own, islands of sovereignty inside the United States. And so that, therefore, you can do things on these reservations that you can't do, in California, which is like surrounds the Cabazon reservation on all sides. And so he actually, implementing this belief in sovereignty, he started selling tax-free cigarettes through mail order and tax-free alcohol. And then he eventually built the first Native American poker casino on this reservation. And from there, it's like, okay, we got the poker going. Let's get some government contracts in here. And he brings the Wacken Hut Corporation in to start getting like ostensibly like minority favored grants because they formed a joint venture with the Native American reservation. They get preferential treatment for certain grants. And then also like they wanted to start doing manufacturing that would be otherwise illegal in the state of California.
And the other thing I want to bring up with Cabazon is that in the Indian reservation, is that the Cabazon Band of Mission Indian Tribe, which is 20-something people strong, was also the tribe that whose case to demarcate whose taxes and where the income from casinos, where they would be taxed, went all the way to the Supreme Court. It is, it's an important law, and the Cabazon Band of Mission Indians is not just part of, American conspiracy theory, history, and lore. It's also a very important part of the actual history, above board history of America. And yeah. In telling the story of how it was that Indian casinos were able to, with much less risk, grow and develop over the course of the 80s and 90s, because no longer did they have to, there was the states definitively were not getting that income. And what's more, there's another important part of this, which is, if you're in the 1970s and you want to open up a poker room, who do you hire and who do you work with to do that? And so there's a lot of newspaper reporting from the time of the 70s at the time that John Philip Nichols shows up and begins working with the Indian reservation, that a bunch of well-known mob outfit associates are on the premises developing this gambling business.
Yeah.
So it's truly like, and it's, this area is like probably like the area of this reservation is probably like maybe like the parking lot at Giant Stadium, like not even. So this
line.
Is like this guy created, I mean, and he was a pretty canny, and shrewd and ultimately and pretty violent figure. But he figured out that like, with this like sovereign citizen strategy, kind of like Clive and Bundy dressed up, with a legalistic Native American facade, was able to, end up creating like this, really like a nest of criminal activity throughout the 80s. And that leads to the second set of murder, or rather the second murders. The reason that there gets to be a plural for sure in Octopus Murders, at least as I first learned about them, which is a triple murder that takes place there in the 1980s prior to the Innslaw affair, but also points to, you know, yet another like crazy set of violence that, you know, gets dealt out in association with the actors of this conspiracy, so to speak.
Could I just kind of back us through, because it gets so complicated, but I just think it's a helpful lens to look at this through a little bit of who John Philip Nichols is and get to that triple homicide. Is like, looking at it backwards from now, the Cabazon versus the state of California verdict in the Supreme Court, which took place in the mid to late 80s, is, like you said, an extremely important what became a law, the Indian Gaming Law, Indian Gaming Act. And it's ostensibly, and I think from talking to Native Americans, a really good thing, right? Because it's the first time in the tortured history of U.S. versus Native American relations where you don't just have money that's just doled out to these tribes. It's a way that the tribes can actually fund themselves and employ themselves. And it's brought a huge boon. And maybe people think, oh, like gambling, it's shady, it's weird. I have very few opinions on that. But in terms of employment and self-determination, it's really powerful and objectively seemingly, I would say, good thing, right? It just so happens that our story, and we don't even have time to really get into it in the documentary, so it's nice to bring it up here. It happens to kind of stem from this guy, Dr. John Philip Nichols, who has a very odd background, showing up at this tribe saying, I can help you guys. And his background that we touch on seems to be in the nexus point between union Teamsters background, work in Milwaukee and Washington, D.C., the mafia because of its associations with Jimmy Hoffa and his associations in the mafia, and John Nichols' own associations with the mafia. And the intelligence world. And John Nichols is showing up to this tribe saying, I'm like a government grant helper dude, but he's not necessarily mentioning the work that he's done in Chile and Brazil, where he was in the forefront of right before all these anti-communist coups. You got John Nichols down there in Chile hanging out as an evangelical leader, organizing voting blocks of people, peasants mostly, to vote against Allende and keep it as a pro-U.S. government. So he's one of the most fascinating people I've ever researched or heard about. But he's got this weird legacy as this Indian gaming law that nobody really talks about his association with it. But the stew of the world he comes from, intelligence, mob, unions, all that stuff, just brings to bear on this tiny tribe in Southern California.
Yeah, and think about Doc Phillips, if you'll indulge me another film reference here. He really reminded me a lot of Robert De Niro's character in Killers of the Flower Moon as this like very shady guy with a lot of, I would say, suspiciously close relationships with the indigenous communities, as you said, Zachary, in countries that just happen to have right-wing dictatorships imposed on them right after he left town. But how do you think he leveraged this? Because like, you interview his son in the movie, he describes him in a positive light as an agent of social change. How did he leverage his relationships with these communities to create a private interzone of deep state intelligence, organized crime, weapons manufacturing, and crime?
It's so complicated. I mean, I just love this story so much because it's so fascinating. And I love Bobby's view of his dad because it's so complicated thinking about his father. He loves his dad, and his dad, was a powerful part of his life, obviously. And he looks at his dad as somebody who ultimately, weirdly, whether he even wanted to or not, created the wealth of ultimately did what he set out to do. Right now, the Cabazons have a shiny casino. They make a lot of money doing that, and it's a good thing.
So many tribes
around the country, and it's almost like an accident of history if you look at it through our viewpoint that that even happened, because John Nichols seems to have really been mostly interested in these quasi-intelligence projects.
And also, I think that that's, I think I agree totally. And I think that it's also points to one of the things about this case that to me is so, like, you know, what makes it so it can fill a full four-part series, for example, is that, like, you know, and there's a lot that we won't touch on in this interview, but as viewers will see, that there are other kinds of, you know, dimensions or figures who come up who have other connections to seemingly important parts of, you know, major social developments, let's say. And to me, it's not evidence again of, like, you know, some, like, a grand, far-reaching, centralized anything, but just a way of showing how if you do look at these kinds of stories quite often, I think that it shows that you can find how power structures all over the country and abroad work. And it shows how similar they all are in many respects.
I mean, along those lines, like another major thread in American history that the tentacles of the octopus get into and the promise system is connected to is the Iran-Contra scandal. Because you talk about a man named Ed Bryan, his relationship to the Reagan administration, and how the promise system is in you're telling the story, essentially a payoff to him for arranging the release of the Iranian hostages right after Reagan's election.
Yeah, it's just so you know, it's Earl Bryan.
Earl Bryan, sorry.
So Earl Bryan was a guy who knew, oh my gosh, there's actually so much on Earl Bryan that we don't even get into in this. He was a neurosurgeon in California, one of the youngest people, I think the youngest people at the time to be head of California's Health and Human Services, whatever that's called now.
Likely part of the Phoenix, Operation Phoenix in Vietnam.
Allegedly was, he was a neurosurgeon who went over to Vietnam as a young man, came back extremely decorated.
Neurosurgeon who went to Vietnam and worked in the Phoenix program. I mean, the mind only begins to conjure up what that entailed.
But, you know, the Phoenix stuff is all pretty under wraps. That's been an allegation that's thrown around a lot. And then suddenly he's in Reagan's cabinet when Reagan is governor of California. And he after he left government, he started a bunch of different companies. And one of them is this company that tried to buy InSlaw and buy the Promise software from InSlaw in the 80s. And
Bill refused to sell it.
Bill refused
and
to sell it.
A representative of the company said, well, we have ways of making you sell. And Bill's like looking at the receiver like, what's this guy? You know, this is idiot.
Yeah, I'm a software company. I'm running numbers in Chicago.
Like. Yeah.
And so, but Earl Bryan is close friends with Ed Meese, who was, you know, in the Reagan campaign and then became eventually Reagan's attorney general. And he's just kind of like a kitchen cabinet member, is, you know, how you say it, of Reagan's entourage, Earl Bryan is. And he owns, we don't even get into this. At the time, he owned Financial News Network, which was eventually sold and became CNBC. He owns the competitor to the AP, a major player in the news industry at the time, which was UPI, United Press International. I don't know if you're listening. He's very much like a almost a Robert Maxwell-ish character in some respects.
That name will strike a chord with our
listeners. There's a bit of the Maxwell in Earl Bryan.
And interestingly, Maxwell, the allegation is that Earl Bryan was selling Promise software for the U.S. government, the pirated version with the backdoor in it, and a doppelganger in the U.K., Robert Maxwell, who was a agent for Israeli intelligence, was selling the Promise software for Israeli interests. So it's interesting.
Yeah, there's all kinds of symmetry there. And so anyway, the thing is that Michael kind of puts into context, and I just want to say it's Michael's view. It's not our view, and it's not it's not our view. Is that not necessarily? Is that Earl Bryan went to, during the campaign for Reagan to become president, when he was trying to take Jimmy Carter's, you know, job in 1980, that Earl Bryan went over to Iran because he spoke Farsi and had connections
and had business
there.
Connection. He already was a vendor to the Iranian government. So he had already had connections there.
and that he and Michael puts himself into this story, that he and Michael went to Iran and were involved with a $40 million transaction where the hostages that had been taken in Iran and after the revolution in 1979, 52 American hostages, would be kept in Iran until after the election, so that Jimmy Carter, you know, would be this weak on Iran president who couldn't get them out. And then Ronald Reagan comes in, saves the day, gets the hostages out, and he looks like a hero. And if you want to look at history through that lens, a lot of it makes sense in that the hostages were released the day, you know, within a few minutes of Reagan's inauguration.
It's also worth kind of adding that there's now evidence, including a front page story in the New York Times from this past year, that sort of illustrates that the Reagan October surprise wasn't like one plot so much as it was, you know, whereas we're seeing the contours of it in time, a deliberate effort, like, you know, an all hands on deck kind of thing with anybody who could have a plausible way of reaching the Iranians to get them to do exactly what they ended up doing. And the New York Times reporter, Peter Baker, their White House reporter, published a story about a Texas politician named Ben Barnes, who was like fantastically corrupt in his day working in politics there, who copped to being part of this plan, who copped to being part of the plot.
The campaign manager for Ronald Reagan was William Casey, who is a legend of the OSS, which preceded the CIA, and then after the election became the CIA, the director of the CIA during the entire Reagan administration until he died very conveniently right before testifying in Iran-Contra. That is important. The fucking October surprise happened. I'm sorry. I don't give a fuck. I don't care what you say. It fucking happened. But it definitely happened. The 1980 election was rigged. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, the Republicans.
But Michael puts himself into this position. And I think that's the thing that we don't necessarily vouch for, which is that Michael has a tendency to kind of throw himself into the middle of these giant milieus where you're just like, damn, dude, you're in the desert and you're also you're in the California desert. You're in Iran. You're in Washington State. Like, you're in an unbelievable amount of places with an unbelievable group of people. And the problem for us eventually was that, not necessarily on our October surprise, but other stories where he seemed to be in very strange people with very strange places with very powerful people, he just was. And it's like, we document it. And so it becomes hard to figure out what's real and what's not.
And when you're watching a movie, like, Michael Ricconosciuto is not the kind of guy who looks like he would be in a room with Bill Casey or Frank Carlucci or like in that world. He's a very weird sort of
Bill
nerdy.
Bill Casey's kind
like
of a weird looking dude,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's sort of a shabby looking individual who also happens to be a genius on a number of levels.
There's a story about Bill Casey or Michael. There's a story that we don't even get into, which is that John Nichols went to the Picatinny Arsenal, which is the large artillery testing or development lab in New Jersey for the Army. And they go there and Michael walks in. He is very shabby, like you said. I think somebody said that he was just in deep need of a shower. And he's just chopping it up with these physicists about how, you know, ways to do things like the railgun, which is an experimental weapon at the time and still is sort of an experimental weapon, with the idea of taking simple electric energy to create a projectile that is, you know, damaging. Michael was looking at it as a way to shoot satellites out of the sky with a projectile. And there he is in Picatinny Arsenal with John Philip Nichols, just doing blackboard exercises, you know, physics exercises. He's not there.
We called the physicist from DARPA and asked him about it, and he confirmed the story.
Yeah. Jeez.
And this is a guy who's like, the last episode that I saw is the footage of him getting out of California prison after doing a 26-year stretch for manufacturing methamphetamine. Which is also a bit odd as well, that you interview a law enforcement officer who says, I've arrested who knows how many people for manufacturing meth, and then none of them got 26-year sentences in prison.
Yeah, John Powers, working as a detective in Riverside County, saw a few meth cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think the federal system is definitely different than Michael's, and maybe there was aggravated stuff on top of that. Just to sort of get, I like to give the benefit of doubt as much as possible to every single person in this story, and then even when you're being nice, see what's remaining. And what's remaining is like Michael. Did himself, I think, zero favors in his prison sentence and stuff like that. But and he was claiming that it was retribution for him coming forward about the Inslaw story, the October surprise, what happened in the desert in California, all this stuff. And you know, it's, you look at what happened and the people he was dealing with, and you can definitely see a world in which these people would not want him out in the world talking. That's just, there's every reason for him not to be talking.
There's a couple people that I don't think we'll have time to get to in the course of this conversation, but there is one more person who I think you focus on in the story that I think rightfully so. And he's really, really interesting. And he's another guy with the last name Nichols, but unrelated to this other Nichols. And this guy is Robert Booth Nichols, or we can just call him Booth. And Booth is somebody who you guys find may be more, you know, if people are looking at those who may have been connected to the circumstances of Danny's death in West Virginia, Booth may be someplace to start looking more than others. So I was a bit curious about how he comes into the picture for you guys researching this, and what made him the uniquely menacing figure that he was.
I think Christian should answer this, but I just want to say, Robert Nichols, for me as a filmmaker, comes in as Michael's nemesis. They had worked together in Cabazon, and they had
oh, so gone like off. Michael's Dwight and Dwight Schrute, and Booth Nichols is Michael Scott.
Yeah, it's a sort of classic pairing, and they're both talking to Danny, and they both hate each other, and they're talking about what they had done in their respective, and they're bouncing off of their information off of Danny, and he's like kind of a go between, and so but. Christian, yeah, who is Robert Booth Nichols?
Assistant to the International Man of Mystery. Robert Booth Nichols enters the story at Cabazon as well. There was a in the effort to sell weapons to the Nicaraguan Contras, there was a weapons demonstration of some night vision goggles and some machine guns, and Robert Booth Nichols had a patent for a small, cheap to manufacture submachine gun that looks very similar to the MAC-10 and called the G77, I think. It doesn't matter. It's not, you can't go to the store and buy one, I don't think. And so that's how he enters into the story. And then sort of like when Cabazon, one of the tribal members is murdered in a hit hired by all accounts by John Philip Nichols, who had a habit of hiring hits on people throughout the 80s and into the 90s. And so everything kind of falls apart at Cabazon, and Robert Booth Nichols and Michael then start their own company called Meridian International Logistics. And they're trying to get their own government contracts. But then something happens, and Michael and Robert have this huge falling out. And by the time, but Michael had told Danny about this guy, Robert. And so Danny tracks down Robert Booth Nichols, and they start having long telephone conversations, which we have, you know, we have a lot of Danny's phone bills, and you can see that Danny will call Robert at you know, midnight in Virginia, which is whatever, 9 p.m. in LA. And they'll talk until it's like 3:30 in the morning for Danny. And you can see that Danny's back up at 6 or 7 a.m. like talking to Bill Hamilton. He's like, you know, he's not sleeping. He's just like running the phone and running this investigation. And yeah, for some reason, and it's really hard, it's really unclear, but Robert Booth Nichols is sort of a famous figure on the internet and in conspiracy lore. But in 1991, he was a totally vague guy it was a name that, you know, he got from Michael. And
why though is he a figure? Because like I think you're selling only slightly short. Like this guy is like a fucking, like he's more than the other people you put on screen. He's like, you know, he's at once kind of scary, but he's also like kind of got like the sweaty desperation that like a lot of criminals sort of exude when a microscope or a magnifying glass comes anywhere near them. Like, you know, like, what is it? What was it like? I'm curious for you to, your take on his like personality, his uniqueness.
He's a money launderer. He's got close connections to the Gambino crime family. He's got connections to the intelligence community. You know, he's from a very wealthy family in Los Angeles. His dad was a renowned doctor. They lived in the Hollywood Hills. I think didn't each of the kids have their own like cars, like nice
Porsches.
Cars?
Yeah, Porsches, when they were 16.
He was just a drive around. The parents were always traveling. The kids just like had control of this house in the Hollywood Hills. And then Robert Booth Nichols dodges the draft. None of this even made it into the movie, but Robert Booth Nichols dodges the draft supposedly and ends up in Hawaii and gets picked up for. I mean, why would you go? You're not even crossing. You're still in the United States. And so the story goes, that's when he got recruited by the intelligence community. But he does start working with an alleged organized crime figure in Hawaii named Harold Akimoto, who, you know, he kind of becomes his mentor. And, you know, when Robert Booth Nichols was married a few years into his relationship with Akimoto was like served as his father. His father wasn't invited, but Akimoto was like his dad. And so then, you know, he goes to Switzerland and learns banking. And throughout the 70s, it's hard to say exactly what he does. He has multiple properties all over the world. He always flies first class. He always stays at world-class hotels, but he doesn't have a job. What does he do? I don't know. I don't know what he does. He doesn't do anything, but he's got a lot of money. I mean, I don't think he is disowned by his family. I don't think his dad was rich. He had a Porsche when he was 16 or whatever. But I don't think that.
Can we just tell one story that was like a moment in time for me while we were making this, which is that Christian, we found a name of somebody who knew Robert Wood Nichols and we called this guy up. We won't say any names, but, you know, not many people know Robert Nichols anymore that are still alive. And this guy, Christian, calls up and he's like, oh, Bob. Yeah, he was one of the baddest guys in the NSA. He used to go and be sent off as like, because he looked kind of like a Clark Gable kind of guy. He used to be sent. You think that when people are, you know, you have spies sent in to seduce prime ministers. Well, what happens when you send Bob over there to seduce the secretary? and that he was somehow this intelligence operative who was, you know, not only handling sort of like financial crimes and stuff like that. But that he was the super spy guy. And then he had also spent some time in Vietnam. And what's weird is like, it all kind of checks out. Cause he had this tourism business where he was taking people over to Vietnam. Anyway, but the point is like, this guy's like, oh, you're dealing with Bob. You're dealing with some dangerous folks. Okay. Here's what you need to do. He's like, you know, Michael. And we're like, yeah, we know Michael. He's like, Michael's a good guy. Bob, not so much. Here's what you need to do. I'm going to send you a plutonium tipped bullets. Okay. And I'm going to teach you how to make your own gun because you're going to need something special to deal with all these people who are going to come through your door. So I need you to get a 10 millimeter, not a 9 millimeter, a 10 millimeter barrel. And I'm going to send you the components through the mail because, you know, when these guys come through the door, they're not that smart. Okay. You can take them on, you know, and Christian's like, whoa, 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 what are we talking about? He's like, they're going to come after you and you need to be prepared. It's like, dude, we just wanted to talk about Bob's life 40 years ago or 30 years ago. Now you're talking about plutonium tipped bullets.
Who is he, the Terminator? Jesus.
This is a really good segue to what I wanted to get to next, which was, you know, that like your documentary is about, like, it begins with the death of Danny Casalero, but there's a neat trick that you guys do as a device. You weave not only like the story of yourselves making this and just how complicated and tough it is, but also you sort of pose the question, you know, like Christian, you know, did he get a little bit lost in the sauce on this? Did he get a little bit too far in the weeds on this? And, you know, the thing is that rather than portray it actually as like a stereotypical rabbit hole narrative, like you guys made a 4-part Netflix series out of it. And like, I think tell a pretty cogent story. And, you know, end on a note of saying, like, you can live your lives, too. Like, it's you don't have to, like, be oppressed by the knowledge that bad people do things in dark fields at night. like, I was kind of curious, you know, how you like made that, like how you got from that place of thinking like, this is a crazy obsession I have, I'm going to make a book out of this, to we are going to make a movie.
Well, that's a good question for Zach. But I was reminded of that. There was a New York Times, I think, podcast about ultimately about the YouTube algorithm. And this guy just is like watching YouTube and he just never presses off. And the videos that are playing just get more and more dark. And he just gets his brain gets totally scrambled by like QAnon conspiracy crap. And he goes like totally nuts, just like from watching YouTube videos. And like the sort of, then he sees the light, maybe gets a New York Times subscription or something and realizes that like,
they see it.
And it's like this, like, it really is very literally like a cautionary tale about conspiracy theories. But this is sort of different because I'm like this guy who in the footage is clearly going a little nuts, but and my friend comes along to document it, but then we like solve murders and like document this like conspiracy that's driving me crazy that like actually is largely real. And, you know, we come out okay on the other side.
I guess like, I want to close out. The last question I want to ask you guys is like along those lines of perhaps not keeping your sanity. And I guess my question is, how do you do a project like this? And like we've touched on like maybe 1/100th of the scope of what this investigation actually touches on. But like, how do you take in all this knowledge or try to sort of metabolize it in a way and not see the tentacles of this octopus like everywhere you look nowadays? Because I mean, like, there are a lot of parallels in this story to other high profile conspiracy tinged events, like for instance the Jeffrey Epstein case, who suicided himself on the same day, August 10th, that Danny Casalero did. Also happens to be my birthday, so easy to remember. But I mean when you see current events or like news stories, like how do you see it through the lens of this octopus narrative, or do you see the tentacles everywhere, or do you see them more as like discrete events?
That's a really good question. For me, I what I haven't done yet, I'm illiterate in the modern machinations I of what I documented that was happening in the 80s and early 90s. I haven't gone into, you know, 95, 96, 97, 98 to like track it. My assumption is that if people didn't really get caught and it was extremely lucrative, which it appears to be, it's still going on, but it's evolved and gotten more advanced. And I don't know. But yeah, we do talk about MK Ultra a lot amongst ourselves and apply it to like, you know, Patty Hearst, for instance. We're looking at things that happened in the past. And we, you know, that's just rife with like, you know, who, what major players in history were actually had their brains scrambled by Jolly West, you know? Who knows?
It's who a good among us is ask. Not an MK Ultra test subject?
Yeah.
If you look around the room and you can't tell who the test subject is,
not me for sure. That's for sure. Just want to be really clear.
What about you, Zach? Do you have a take? You're more measured and practical than I am.
I think. I mean, I think that what you said is right. Is that we do it by keeping a tight focus on the time period, even though it's broad. That we're researching, and I try not to generalize, you know, and just say like, well, it's all connected. It's, you know, Epstein's connected here. Okay. If it's connected, like show me how it's connected. And actually,
well, August 10th,
you talk about, you. Yeah. Yeah. If you talk about Epstein, we could actually
numerology. Yeah.
we could do it. And
another way to drive yourself insane.
You know, there's really just enough here for us to sit in our little 80s, 90s, 70s sandbox for the next 20 years, you know, and get deeper and deeper into the stuff that we didn't even have time to do in the show. So it's not really a worry about seeing it everywhere in the modern world, as long as you're sticking with the past, you know, I guess.
I'll give my own unsolicited quickie answer to this one that which is that a few, like last year I wrote this essay, about, the JFK assassination, one of my favorite subjects for Defector. And in the course of one of the books I was reading to research it, I read about this guy who had been a mob lawyer named, or mob affiliate named Gerardo Catena. And I was like, that's really interesting, Katina, because that's like, I've heard that name before. And I realized that I'd heard that name before because Ray Katina is the largest luxury car dealer in the tri-state area. And Gerardo Katina was his uncle. And so there's like a way in which I think that like part of what we, you know, you said about how it's like, well, if somebody doesn't get caught and they made a lot of money, what happens? What happens is they accrue interest. Their kids go to Harvard. You know, they sell more Mercedes. They get a yacht, whatever. They disappear. That's the, you know, like that's the privileged purchase with the, with, you know, with what
Robert
they've
Maxwell
escaped
got a yacht.
Yes, he did.
See what
yes,
that
he
got did. Him.
And he got a free trip with it, too.
Yeah.
And his daughter now sells a software in the UK that's extremely curiously similar to Promise.
Oh, wait, Noculin.
No, the other the one? Other, yeah. Well, yeah, you know, yeah. If you're a foreign government that's bought the Promise software anytime over the last 40 years, you just may have been backdoored by the NSA. You may have just given up the crown jewels to the U.S. government. Well, Zachary and Christian, I want to thank you for your time, and I want to thank you for your work on the Octopus Murders. I'm probably going to finish it this afternoon, but it is, as I'll reiterate, a fascinating and terrifying look into the secret empire and this like nexus of crime and intelligence that is sort of underwrites the history of the latter half of the 20th century. So thank you guys both so much for taking the time.
Such a fun conversation. Thanks so much, Will and Noah, and I'm down to come back anytime. This was really a lot of fun for
thank
me.
You all.
No problem.
Take it anytime. Easy.
Take it easy, fellas.
Bye.